is The Illusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, sell language a monorail. No refunds! In this episode, we're headed to the planet Mercury. Bring a packed lunch and your strongest sunscreen. And on the subject of space, I'm excited to say that there will be a live space-themed Illusionist performance on the 18th of April in the Planetarium at the H.R. Macmillan Space Centre in Vancouver, BC. I have wanted to do a show in a planetarium for so long, and your ticket includes not just a delightful dose of celestial illusionist as you watch nebulae swirling over your head, but also a talk by astronomer Marley Laycock about space words such as spaghettification. And you get to see all of the Space Centre's exhibits and science demonstrations. Tickets are on sale now. I've linked them at theillusionist.org/events. Early bird pricing until 28th of March. Content note: this episode contains mentions of, but not descriptions of, sexual violence. On with the show.
It really all came to light when I got the opportunity to name my first feature on Mercury, which was, side note, one of the most exciting things, like to find something that is scientifically significant and then to get the chance to name it on another planet. Super cool.
Very
cool. You can't just go about naming anything you want nilly-willy. You have to find something that has some sort of scientific significance. I'm Annie Lennox. I'm a third-year PhD student with the Open University. My background is in terrestrial geology, so Earth-based stuff. But with my PhD, I found myself more moving into planetary geology, specifically the planet Mercury. My project involves mapping the southern quadrangle of Mercury. Mercury's split into these 15 quadrangles, and mine is H15 down in the south. And alongside the mapping, I have some interest in interesting craters that formed all across Mercury with interesting ejecta patterns, and also volcanology, specifically small-scale effusive volcanology.
While mapping the H15 quadrangle, in 2022, Annie discovered a crater that had not been logged before. The images she and the research team were working from were the first capturing that region of Mercury in sunlight. Because she had been the one to discover the crater, Annie got to name it.
So I was so excited by that opportunity. I really wanted to name my first real discovery after a woman, particularly a Scottish woman, just so I felt that there was a little bit of representation for me up there. I thought that would be really kind of cool.
There is an organisation that decides whether a space discovery is deserving of a name, and if it is, which names will be allowed.
It's the International Astronomical Union, the IAU. They are an organisation that deal with name requests. They either accept or reject them. So you appeal to them, first of all, and say, this thing that I've found, does it deserve a name? And then they'll come back saying yes or no. And at that point, you can suggest a name. But ultimately, if the IAU don't like your suggestion, they can just pick their own name. Which nearly it happened with my first naming experience. My first couple suggestions weren't actually accepted.
The IAU sets conventions after which things can be named.
Those conventions are a set of rules that dictate the kind of themes that you can name things on all planets. So there's different conventions, be it on the Moon or on Mars, or as I was looking on Mercury.
There are conventions for each of the different kinds of features on the surface of each planet and moon and planetoid and so on. For example, craters on Jupiter's moon Europa are named after Celtic mythical figures. Craters on the planetoid Ceres are named after agricultural deities, since the planetoid itself is too. On Mercury, faculae, or bright spots, are named after different languages' word for snake. On Mars, small craters are named after towns on Earth with populations under 100,000, and craters larger than 50 kilometres across are named after writers and scientists who did significant work about Mars. The IAU was founded in 1919, but some of the conventions had already been going for hundreds of years by that point. In the mid-1600s, Italian astronomer Giovanni Battista Riccioli started giving weather-related names to lunar areas like the Mare Tranquillitatis, the Sea of Tranquility, and Oceanus Procellarum, the Ocean of Storms. These names still stand, so some of the IAU's systems are ones that they inherited.
And they kind of had to either create conventions around those or just having a few that don't really fit with the conventions. For a lot of features, and actually particularly creators, these get named after real people who have made, you know, real contributions and should be celebrated. Within that, some of them are named after scientists, some of them are named after artists. There's different careers of people. But it's always the case that that individual must have been historically significant for at least 50 years. So you're thinking about 50 years of kind of fame and recognition. And they must be deceased from 3 years. So that's really one of the main issues I personally have with the conventions. If we are judging on things like historic recognition and fame and these kind of metrics, when we look back in history at who was allowed to achieve fame and recognition and status, that is not a diverse pool of people. And so it's unsurprising if we are going with the grain of that, that we end up having quite overrepresentation of cis white men and lacking in pretty much all other forms of diversity. And so with the whole naming process, it really brought to my attention some clear issues in terms of gender diversity, yes, but really all sorts of diversity imbalances across the solar system. I was very much brought to it through the light of there not being good representation for women, but guaranteed as soon as women are missing from the narrative, other forms of diversity are certainly also. But one of the main issues is this has never been researched. You know, they just kept naming things and not really, I think, considering about who they were naming these after. And so there's no real accountability or transparency of what's been named and how that reflects humanity and all the different types of people that we should be celebrating. And so I think part of the issue is that there's just kind of a lack of understanding about how bad this imbalance really is. So the whole project has kind of sprung from that opportunity of getting to name things.
When naming the crater she discovered, Annie followed the IAU's naming convention for craters on Mercury, which is as follows. Deceased artists, musicians, painters and authors who have made outstanding or fundamental contributions to their field and have been recognised as art historically significant figures for more than 50 years. So Annie suggested some women who fit that bill.
I put forward one name, which was Sheila Stewart, who was a traveller and tradition bearer. Her name wasn't accepted because there was already a different Stuart on the moon. And that's one of the issues. There's this kind of de facto male occupation of space where the men got there first and so they have their names and you can't have a woman who might share a last name represented also. So that got rejected. And then my second suggestion was Mary Brooksbank. I was like, there's not going to be another Brooksbank. That's surely a safe name. And right enough, there wasn't, but that also got rejected. Now, that was on the basis of her being too politically significant. For a real person's name to be accepted, they cannot be politically, religiously or military significant figures. Now, they never define what they mean by religiously are politically significant. But Mary Brooksbank was considered too political because she had said many times that she was very communist and believed that the world should be a communist place, if not communist socialist. And lots of her songs and poems kind of reflected that. Now that sparked a little bit of feminine rage in me in that there was one crater on Mercury called the Neruda crater. And actually a 15th of Mercury's globe was called the Neruda quadrangle. So this person was very well represented. The origin of that name is Pablo Neruda, who was a Chilean poet. Now he was also sat on the communist Senate party. So I would argue that's fairly politically significant. Now, not only that, but he had self-written accounts of him committing rape and really other awful deeds. And so actually one little bit of action that's happened is that we brought this to the attention of the IAU, the International Astronomical Union, and they, with that information, changed the origin of that crater. So it is still called the Neruda crater. What we did is we found another artist who also had the last name Neruda and switched the origin. So it no longer reflects Pablo Neruda.
How open was the IAU to you renaming the Neruda crater after a different Neruda? Like, how much of a deal was that?
Yeah, it was... It's an interesting one. It had first been brought to their attention by my colleague, Ben Mann, who was mapping the Naruda Quadrangle. And so he had emailed them ages back saying, do you realise that Naruda actually has this quite horrid history? And at the time, they'd sent a response that was kind of like, we do empathise with that, but we don't want to change the name because it's been called that for so long and these kind of things.
Not that long. The crater was only named for Pablo Neruda in 2008, and the quadrangle even more recently than that. There are items on my mother's spice rack that went out of date before anything on Mercury was named for Pablo Neruda.
It's not a great reason, and it was kind of put to bed for a while, but then the more involved I got with this whole equality and diversity and naming issue, we kind of revisited it then and said, actually, this is something that really should change. And once we'd found appropriate people to change the name to, they were actually quite open to it, and that the way it got changed was actually quite quick. So I think you just have to know to prod the right places.
The Neruda crater is now officially named for the 18th century Czech composer Johann Baptist Neruda and the 19th century Czech poet and journalist Jan Neruda.
Unfortunately, it still reflects a cis white man, but, you know, baby steps. But it's an upward battle.
Meanwhile, Annie's search continued for a name that the IAU would approve for her crater.
After those two initial rejections, I think they'd cottoned on that I'd wanted to name this after a woman. And they gave me this list of women, just kind of names plucked from a directory of women musicians, which I just didn't like because none of them meant anything to me. And I felt it was such low effort to just be like, okay, we'll just pick one from this dictionary, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, that wasn't for me. I ended up sending a list of, I think, 10 other women, all of whom I thought were super deserving of being represented. And I put that forward to the IAU. And they said of those 10, two would be considered appropriate. So I picked my favourite of those two, and that was Lady Caroline Nairn. It's known as the Nairn Crater now. And she was a Scottish poet and songwriter. Oh, she's an incredible person, but an awful lot of her poems were actually wrongly attributed to Robert Burns or other male poets at the time. And that's because she never published under her own name. It wasn't proper in her day for a lady to be a poet. And so she published most of her work under pseudonyms. And I think there's some real poetic justice that she didn't get the recognition that she deserved in her own time. But now she's represented on a whole other planet. I like that as a story. But I did feel like it was difficult to get that goal of naming this discovery after a woman.
This whole process of naming her first crater sent Annie on another voyage to unknown territory, gathering statistics of who the eponymous space features are named after.
On Mars and the Moon, where for a real person's name to be represented, that person must have been a scientist, women feature just 2%, which is really pretty dire. It's not great at all.
Mercury is good in comparison, though still not good. 88.4% of craters on Mercury are named after men.
There was a massive overrepresentation of Europeans, unsurprisingly. And when we broke that down, it was mostly cis white Italian men that were represented.
Oh, how did they get all over Mercury's craters?
I know. Well, It's kind of unsurprising. The convention for craters on Mercury is to adopt the names of artists. And that's not just, you know, painters. It's authors, it's architects, it's choreographers, whatever you want. Which, historically, slightly less exclusionary than, for example, science. However, there was still only less than 12% of women who had craters named after them on Mercury. And I think 12% just irrefutably does not reflect all of women's contribution to the entire history of art. You know, I just thought that was kind of outrageous. To an extent, I kind of get it for example, the moon. The moon has been a target for exploration for hundreds of years. You know, people have been looking at it forever and they've been naming it for as long as they've been looking at it. And so part of the issue is a function of time. You know, when we look back historically, the space sector was itself less diverse and less inclined to name things after a diverse array of people. Mercury, to some extent, doesn't have that as an excuse. Mercury has only had two previous missions, the first being in the 70s and then the second, 2015, that kind of age. So by then, you know, diversity was a bit more at the forefront of the scientific community. And even then, there's still a massive imbalance. So it can't exclusively be a function of the time at which these things were identified or named.
There's one planet where all features have to be given women's names, and that's Venus, the only planet in our solar system named after a female deity.
Oh, yes, yes, that's a minefield. Yeah, I suppose there's kind of an argument that perhaps gender parity at least is not needed on these planets because, you know, us women have Venus, a planet where all things are supposed to be named after women. But I think what's really crucial here is that the women on Venus do not have to be real.
Annie found that only 38% of the craters on Venus that are named have been named after a real person.
Rather, they have the names of mythological characters who are more often celebrated, you know, for their beauty or their fertility or their sexuality, rather than their contributions. Or there's a massive proportion of craters that just have typically female first names. So there's an Abigail crater, there's a Lucy crater. These don't reflect any real women who might have made real contributions to society. These are just arbitrary names picked from the heavens, you know?
They've just gone into the baby names book and picked some white British names.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Which I think is ridiculous. You have all these other planets that massively celebrate the contributions of men. And on the one planet that's supposed to celebrate women, there aren't enough real women that fit those conventions that they've had to revert to these mythological characters or arbitrary names. And that's quite disappointing.
As Annie noted earlier, it's not just gender which has a representational imbalance in space features. As well as being predominantly male, the eponyms skew white, European, and publicly cisgender and heterosexual.
The work that I'd done just myself ended up being quite gender focused. And that is simply because even just considering that one form of diversity was so much work for one person. It meant going through, hundreds of named, I focused on craters, going through hundreds of named craters and manually trying to work out the gender identity of that person, which when you're talking about historical figures, it's not always that easy.
And Annie is just one person, and this isn't even her job. This is what she's been working on while doing her PhD. So to try to quantify representation or shortfalls thereof in space science nomenclature, Annie has been running planetary science hackathons, where volunteers research the people behind the space eponyms.
The whole aim of these hackathons was to bring people together who were interested both in space science but also in how things were named and find out exactly who was overrepresented, underrepresented and missing entirely from space science nomenclature. That wasn't limited to gender by any means. We looked into nationality, first of all, by continent, and then also we're looking into, you know, country by country. It's quite a big undertaking going through every named feature in the whole solar system and trying to find out who that person was. Mm. Especially because so many historic people, you know, we're trying to collect information on things like sexuality and religion. And sometimes you have to just go on whether they were married in a church and that tells you the indication. It's not a perfect way of doing it. You can't go back in time and ask that person how they identify.
Yeah, because if people have been dead long enough to qualify to be a space eponym, then it was much more difficult for them to be out, for instance.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, totally. But the point is that doing this and doing it, acknowledging that it's not perfect, is better than not having that resource at all. Ideally, this will be presented to the International Astronomical Union and can be integrated with their current database of named features and then going forward can be maintained. That's what I would love.
So you're doing all of the space features, not just craters?
That's right, yeah.
No biggie.
I know, all of them. No bother at all. I'm super stoked.
So many bloody moons. Just moons all over the place.
I know. Actually, some of the moons that we've been looking at are interesting ones because they tend, like Venus, to have a lot of mythological characters or people represented. And so one of the diversity things that we can look into is whether there's an overrepresentation of certain mythologies, which there certainly is. Like almost all of it is Roman, or if not Roman, probably Greek. But there are cases of Celtic mythology being used and Egyptian. But even within characters of whatever religion, we're still looking into whether it's mostly gods or if there's equal gods and goddesses. Sexuality is a really weird one to do with that, because what was sexuality in the time of ancient Greece? You know, everyone just loved everything.
Zeus would stop at nothing.
Yes. So it's, there's an awful lot of things to unpick, but it is really interesting.
Just going to take a quick break for the earthly business of paying the bills, thanks to our generous sponsors. Thanks to Home Chef for sponsoring The Illusionist. Home Chef meal kits contain pre-portioned ingredients and are delivered to your door, so you can do some home chefing without having to go grocery shopping. And if you're like me and have decision fatigue, Home Chef takes the hassle out of making choices, because here's what's for dinner and here's how to make it. They offer classic meal kits with speedy recipes ready in less than 30 minutes. But if you want something even easier, they've got oven-ready kits with pre-chopped ingredients or quick microwave meals that assemble in minutes. Home Chef has over 30 options a week and serves a variety of dietary needs, so you do not have to worry about what to make ahead of time. For a limited time, Home Chef is offering Illusionist listeners 18 free meals, plus free shipping on your first box and free dessert for life at homechef.com/illusionist. That's homechef.com/illusionist for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You must be an active subscriber to receive free dessert. So become one at homechef.com/illusionist. The Illusionist is sponsored by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for building and running your own beautiful website that you can get going in just one evening. Why wait any longer to get your eponym top trumps online? All the eponyms you know, scored by how good the person's name looks on a street sign, how regrettable they might be in future, whether they got the eponym as an honour, a diss, or because they were the first person to die of a particular disease. Eponym top trumps, come on! It's the game just waiting to sweep the interwaves and the playground. And you can secure the relevant domains via Squarespace. I just checked, and eponymtoptrumps.com is available, as are eponymtoptrumps.wtf and eponymtoptrumps.gripe. But those cost 3.5 times more than the .com. Discontent is expensive, as proven by eponymtoptrumps.fun being cheaper. Head to squarespace.com/illusionist for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code illusionist to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. And now back to The Craters of Mercury with Annie Lennox. I've been covering the eponyms beat for much of this show's 9-year lifespan. And during that time, I became increasingly beset by the question, should eponyms be stopped? Would it just be easier not to name things after people?
It's a question I've been asked before, and I'm in two minds, because really, there's not a right way to name things after people. Inevitably, it will start off being quite imbalanced. That's a trap that we've always fallen into, whether it's naming road signs or statues or features on planets. Always it's cis white male who are first and foremostly represented. That being said, I think there's something so lovely about having a bit of humanity within science. You know, science can be incredibly, well, it has to be data driven and it has to be many things. And sometimes human and compassionate doesn't always have a place there. And I think there should be. So I do love the idea of having a little bit of humanity represented.
You can sometimes see where scientists were having fun too.
We have one large crater with On top of it, it's got two overlying smaller craters. And so that's the Disney crater, because it's very much the little the Disney ears.
Yeah, are they like, well, now you can't publish photos of it without paying Disney for the likeness?
Yeah, probably, no doubt. The ones we've had rejected, which I'm a little sad about, is someone tried to name something after Freddie Mercury, so it would have been the Mercury crater on Mercury, which would have been great, but it's not happening.
It's not just the outright eponyms that present difficulties either.
Tectonic features on Mercury called rupees, they're named after ships. Actually, one of the problems that's come to light with that is that for many places, ships are named after significant political figures. All of Russia do that, certainly. And so you kind of feel like you're supporting that politician rather than the research vessel. And also, I don't even know if that would be accepted because of this political rule. But one that I'm not sure if it was someone just said they were going to submit it or if it was actually rejected. But they could, in theory, have a Boaty McBoatface rupees, which I think I would be in support of.
Yeah, I was thinking if we did stop with the eponymy, does that mean you're going to get a lot of Crater McCraterface?
Yeah, almost definitely. Yeah. Well, when you're involved in scientific missions as well, there's quite a lot of cases where if you're looking at a small area, people are just going to start their own informal classification systems because you can't go through the IAU for those timescales. And also sometimes it's just like they've got an interesting boulder or a ridge or something. And so there is no convention for those type of features. So you get a lot of people of things to just call like the mound and... Someone suggested the other day to start naming certain features in their area after ice cream flavours, things like that, just their own informal systems, which I'm not mad about.
No, although people can get very heated about which is the best flavour, so it's always potential for fights.
There's always potential to anger someone.
Whenever I talk about this stuff, I get some angry people complaining about raising it. What kind of responses mm-hmm. did you get when you were first publicly talking about this?
My first couple outings when I spoke about this were generally really well received, which I think is just as well, because if they weren't, and I got some of my later responses initially, I don't know if I'd have taken this as far as I have. It's a very difficult thing when something is not your PhD project. You know, this is a side project. This is my passion project.
Not getting paid for this.
Exactly. And for folk to tell you, as they have, that it's a waste of time and that I shouldn't be doing it, it's really disheartening.
On the 17th of October 2022, Annie published an open letter to the International Astronomical Union, IAU, Issues of Power and Its Influence on Naming Conventions for Planetary Features. She wrote about the eponym data she had collected, showing the imbalances of representation and how that is perpetuated by some of the problems with the naming conventions.
I've had some really quite entertaining responses. In fact, some of them I've printed out and put here. If you don't mind, I'll read a couple.
I would love it.
Because I think they're really enjoyable. This one here was sent from a professor, a female professor. I was really surprised. And this was in response to the open letter that I put out addressed to the IAU. And she said that perhaps it made sense that all craters were named after men because, and I quote, "craters are very dangerous, bringing explosions, fire and death. Typical male attitude who makes wars everywhere." So I kind of love that. This one was a guy who went to great lengths to stay anonymous. They created a new email, anonymous one.
Always a good sign.
I know. To send me a subject heading, "Are you serious?" And it says, "Hi, I'm a very old physicist. I don't wish to reveal my identity, which nowadays can be changed at will. I came across your event, Planetary Nomenclature Hackathon, organised by you and a few others. I found it just ridiculous. What's good to rewrite history? Go to China and you'll find many places renamed after the communist rule. What's wrong with the percentages you show on the poster?" This is in reflection to the 2% being named after women. "It was by widely agreed conventions at the time."
Widely.
"And the community were dominated by male physicists. Are you great enough to do judges to their achievement? No physicists, so far as I'm aware, through my long career, which would even bother what you were..." What? So sad to see good physics traditions strained by politics in this way. It's called Cultural Revolution in China. I think he's comparing these planetary hackathons to communist China, is what I'm getting.
Certainly
from
does
this.
Seem to be the theme.
Please dig a bit into the catastrophic history when pure physics was meddled by short-sighted politics. It's a waste of time and money. Surely you won't listen and press on ahead, but history will prove me right. May God rest your wrestling heart and may you find joy in real
wow.
physics.
I mean, it seems like he contradicted himself just in that last part.
I know. So when I first put out the open letter, that was a letter addressed to the International Astronomical Union and kind of just laid out what the issue was. And I got, all in all, a pretty good response from that. You know, I expected a little bit of backlash from non-science people who kind of just like to get angry. But I was really disappointed by how many scientists were telling me what a waste of time it was and how this isn't how science should be spent. And that was really disheartening to come from the community.
Were there any pleasant surprises in the ways that people responded?
Oh, yeah, totally. I have a folder on my emails for when I have a bad day, and it's called Nice. And every nice response I've had to putting things out there, I put in that folder, and I can go and read them whenever I'm sad. But it has been really, really well received by and large. The hackathons have been so lovely. It's brought together people from all over, like mostly the UK, because that's where the in-person hubs have been, but also America and further afield. And people are so supportive and share concern and compassion on the issue, which has been a lovely thing to witness. Next hackathon will be in April time. It's very much open to anyone. And so, you know, if there's anyone who might listen who would be excited to be part of it, I would welcome that with open arms, absolutely.
Go to theillusionist.org/craters for information about getting involved with the hackathons and whatever else might come in the future.
It would be a really valuable thing to have perhaps a directory or a place where people can suggest names for these kind of things, because inevitably, it's a small group of quite diversity-minded people that have a massive impact in terms of representation. For example, the area I'm mapping, the craters there, six have been named after women, and half of those have been done by me. You know, so it really is just like a small group that have a big impact. But what would be a great resource is if we could get input from people all over the world and suggesting names. And there's obviously no guarantee that those names could or would be picked. And if they were picked, whether they'd be accepted or rejected. But I think it'd be a really interesting conversation to find out who people want to be represented.
Would you have thought when you were starting this PhD where it was going to take you?
Not at all. Not. I mean, when I started doing geology in general, I didn't even think it would end up going into space. So that was already a bit of a leap. And now that I find myself doing, you know, still my space science work, but so much in terms of equality and diversity, it's not the trajectory I had planned, but it's one that really fuels me in a massive way. Space science is in this really good position where, because exploration is happening so quickly and to such an extent, like it really is the whole universe, conventions are constantly being written because we are exploring more places. And so they're in this unique position where they can now, going forward, start doing conventions that really consider implicit bias and those kind of imbalances of the past and how to counteract those. So I think this might be a good step forward in bringing to light those imbalances and hoping that in the future it gets a bit better.
It's certainly not a step back.
No.
Annie Lennox is approaching the final stretch of her PhD in the geology of Mercury, and she's holding another hackathon in April 2024. So if you want to get involved with researching who all the space eponyms are, you can. I will put the information at theillusionist.org/craters. Staying on the space theme for a moment, G Dune Part 2 was just released, and working on constructing the languages for the film was David J. Peterson. So what a great time to travel through the Allusionist archives and listen to the episode Verisimilitude, wherein David J. Peterson talks about what goes into creating languages for fictional worlds. And it's a lot. There's a really incredible attention to detail. And if you want to help keep the Allusionist going in a highly uncertain media landscape, become a member of the Allusiverse at theallusionist.org/donate, and as well as funding this show, you get fortnightly live streams with me and my collection of reference books. You get behind-the-scenes information about the making of each episode. In this one, there were some things that I didn't want to share publicly, but I will share with the members of the Allusiverse. And best of all, you get the company of your fellow Allusionauts in the Allusiverse Discord community, one of the most wholesome places on the internet. So join us for as little as $2 American a month at theallusionist.org/donate. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is Regulus, noun, chemistry, archaic, a metallic form of a substance obtained by smelting or reduction. Origin 16th century, from Latin, diminutive of rex, red, king. Origin as Regulus of Antimony, apparently so named because of its readiness to combine with gold. Try using Regulus in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman, thanks to Sheila Kanani and Adam Richardson. The music is by Martin Austwick of palebirdmusic.com. Our ad partner is Multitude. If you have a product or thing about which you'd like me to talk with affection and admiration, sponsor the show. Contact Multitude at multitude.productions/ads. Seek out Allusionist Show on the socials, and to hear or read every episode, find links to more information about the topics and people therein, see the full dictionary entries for the randomly selected words, and get tickets to events such as the upcoming live show in the Planetarium at the Macmillan Space Centre in Vancouver, visit the show's forever home, theallusionist.org.